The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Good afternoon and welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community. Your host is Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community. This hour is designed to inspire, inform, and to help you live better with cancer. Now, here's your host, Kim Tibaldo.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, an internet radio show that focuses on informing and inspiring people to live well with cancer. I'm Kim Tibaldo, CEO of the Cancer Support Community. The Wellness Community and Gilda's Club have united to become the Cancer Support Community, one of the largest providers of cancer support in the United States and around the world. Our services are offered at more than 100 locations worldwide and online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. Well, a friend of mine emailed me and told me that I must read Alice and Oliver by Charles Bach. She said it was like no other cancer book she had ever read, and I agree. Alice and Oliver is it's raw, it's jarring, intense, it's emotional, it's exhausting, but it is really everything that people experience when they receive a cancer diagnosis. And although this is a work of fiction, it is based on the author's real life experience. His late wife, Diana Colbert, battled leukemia for 2.5 years and passed away in 2011. I'm honored to have Charles Bach join us on the show to talk about this extraordinary book. But before we get started, let me tell you a little bit about Charles. His first novel, Beautiful Children, was a New York Times bestseller and notable book of the year and won the Sue Kaufman Prize for Best First Novel from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in Harper's, Esquire, the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Slate, the Iowa Review, as well as in numerous anthologies. He's received fellowships from the Civitella Ranieri Foundation in Umbria, Italy, Yaddo, UCross, and the Vermont Studio Center. Welcome to the show, Charles.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me. Thank
you. Absolutely. Well, we've got a lot to cover. This is a deep book and goes across a lot of different planes. So you know, let's just jump right in. Can you tell our listeners, Charles, what the story is about? But no spoilers, please. Obviously, we want folks to get this amazing piece of work and read it. But give us some framework.
Oh, absolutely. The novel takes place in 1993. Alice Colbert is a young mother of a 6-month-old infant, and she and her husband and the baby are about to take a Thanksgiving trip back to mom for, you know, big Thanksgiving weekend, free child care, and she feels ill. She becomes ill. She's been ill for a little less than a week, but this is worse, and she ends up being diagnosed with a complex form of leukemia and needs to have a bone marrow transplant. They need a bone marrow transplant if she's going to live. And this is as a starting point for this novel. It moves through their search, through numerous chemo, through a bone marrow transplant. Both she and her husband, Oliver, deal with the whole thing. Health insurance, hospital bureaucracies, different doctors, the network of friends and family, the financial aspect. Mm. They have a 6-month-old baby that needs to be taken care of. And Alice has to kind of face a lot of questions about not just her own mortality, but then the option, the possibility, or even the prospect of letting go, or what, how does a mother face something like this? And I tried very hard to make this be a book that it is about the cancer. It's unavoidable, but it's also about how do we live. It's very much about life. How do we, what do we owe ourselves? What do we owe the people around us? And how do we treat one another when, you know, the big ticket questions about life really stare you in the face? I think that's a good starting point.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. You know, Charles, the first chapter is pretty abrupt. I mean, within a few paragraphs, having literally just met Alice and Oliver, we're launched into their sort of escalating medical crisis. I mean, was it your intention to recreate for the reader sort of the shock and the disorientation that people say they experience when they receive a cancer diagnosis? Was that your intention?
Absolutely. You know what? It is a shock, and it is so dramatic. And what I tried to do with the novel was to recreate that and to use it almost in the way of a thriller, where a reader is swept up in this. And the truth is, it's unimaginable. And all of a sudden, life changes, and you're in something that you just can't believe. And that was the experience with myself and my late wife, Diana. And when I was trying to figure out how to do this, that I was, if I was going to write about this and how to, then how to do this, I did feel that that was, that to try and recreate that, to try and pull a reader in such a way where it's like a, almost like an action movie and you have no choice but to go along and ride the roller coaster, that felt right to me. Because even though you sit there for hours and you're waiting on results and you're trying to calm each other and figure out what's happening and treatments are going on, you all of a sudden the world has changed, and it's so fast that that was my intent, and that a reader, my hope was that they will be sucked in, and then as the book goes on a little bit, these seeds have been planted for Alice and for Oliver that grow into these complex people, and we're going to learn about them and love them and be frustrated by them and follow them through all this. But my experience really is, or was, that it's so immersive, and I wanted to reflect that.
So just strap in. Here we go.
Yeah.
You know, so as things progress, Charles, you continue to bring us sort of deeper and deeper into really what becomes a life and death crisis. I mean, right alongside Alice and Oliver, and bombarding the reader with medical terms, neutropenic fever, the demand for medical decisions, necessity, personal preference, insurance companies. Did you ever worry that it might be too much, too fast, too intense, for the reader?
You know what? It's a constant, it is a worry. And I do think that what I tried to do was go along one step at a time and introduce something in such a way where we could understand what was going on, and try not to introduce the medical term first, but maybe what's happening. And so we understand what's happening, and then we can give it a name. When this all started, I knew nothing. You know, I was so innocent about most health insurance stuff. I mean, I knew I had kind of bad health insurance, and I had a copay, and sometimes I had to do this, and sometimes I had to do that, let alone the medical terms of that come with serious illness and, you know, and cancer. There's no light cancer, you know. There's no one who gets a diagnosis and is like, oh, well, it's a lymphoma, you know. That gets, a lot of times that can be treated, so I'm not too worried about it. It's, you know, it's really heavy, and it does ask a lot. But the hope also is that if a reader is invested and cares, people are smart, people are capable of understanding, and if you explain it right, they're ready to go along. I mean, that's usually my experience when I read.
Yeah, and I mean, unfortunately, frankly, nowadays, most folks have had some experience with cancer and, you know, either
yes.
firsthand, secondhand, third, you know, third hand.
Well, that's true.
And some connection there. Charles, in fictionalizing your life story, and if that's the right way to put it, because I know we want to get into your own experience and story a little bit in the conversation, but you place Alison Oliver in 1993. What made you pick that time period? Was there something about that that really was relevant to the narrative?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. One is that 1993, late 93 through 94, that's when the first commercial web browser is kind of introduced, Netscape. So the internet, the idea of what the internet is changes. It goes from where we go online and pay to be part of AOL and pay for each minute to where we can be online and surf and go to web pages. It's a time where the book takes place in New York City, Manhattan, and that's a time where Disney moves into Times Square and kind of the gentrification, I guess, or the city changes in a certain way where it starts to really be cleaned up and become a much more kind of corporate place. And I felt, you know, Pulp Fiction actually comes out that year. I felt that there were these milestones where it seems like it's so long ago, or it seems like it's so close, but really now it's 20 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And that would, there's a point where that pays off at the end of the book. But one of the things that I really wanted to do was to make a point that this is a moment in time for these people, and everything is on the line for them, and it is hugely dramatic. But that time is going to pass. The book, everything is going to move forward. That six-month-old infant is going to grow up to be a young woman. And I felt that by dating the book, by making a time when there were still subway tokens, when New York City was still grimy, when people in waiting rooms were reading John Grisham novels, or, you know, a husband and wife each reading a different one, and because that was the book of that was the author of the moment, that I could date it. And I could say, this is something that happens. And then also later, it's something where people's lives or people's time moves forward. It does move forward. And because the book is so dramatic when it starts, because the experience is so immersive, it seemed like that was a good counter for it. Was a way of saying that there's a tunnel, and then there's an other side of the tunnel. Yeah.
Really interesting. Boy, we could have a whole conversation just about that.
Oh, it's so much. Because
and about the context, yeah.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, absolutely.
Yeah. And even what was happening in the medical world
at that time,
the beginning of some important, advances for sure. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We are talking today with author Charles Bach about his new book, Alice and Oliver. We have a lot that we want to cover about this really fascinating and in-depth and intense book. We have a lot to cover with Charles. We're going to take a quick break here. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Thibodeau. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The cancer support community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, The Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
People living with breast cancer often find it difficult to ask for help, and many of the people in their lives want to help but don't know how. During National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Cancer Support Community is proud to support Meal Train, sponsored by Magnolia, which utilizes MealTrain.com, a free shared online calendar to streamline the process of giving and receiving meals for families coping with breast cancer. Help us reach our goal of 1,000 new breast cancer-specific meal trains this October. To learn more, visit mealtrain.com/MMT and enter the code MAGNOLIAB or visit us at cancersupportcommunity.org.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Azi, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Today's episode is being brought to you in part by AstraZeneca and Lilly Oncology. I'm Kim Tibaldo, and with us today is Charles Buck, author of the recently released novel Alice and Oliver. Charles' previous novel, Beautiful Children, was a New York Times bestseller. In this new novel, we meet Alice and Oliver, a young, successful couple with a newborn baby. Everything seems to be going their way when Alice's cancer diagnosis throws their lives into chaos. Charles, your wife, Diana...
Yes.
Kept a journal during her illness, and I know you used that journal to help you create and give voice to Alice. Why don't you take a minute to tell us about Diana and her story, and was she a writer? Do you know what motivated her to keep a journal?
Absolutely. She was someone who wanted to be a writer, and in fact, the first night we met, that was one of the things she talked about, because she... She worked in massage therapy. She wrote grants at a university. And then in the course of our marriage, our relationship and marriage, she actually went back to school to work on a graduate degree in comparative literature and was going to be a teacher. But she had wanted to write. Mm. And when during the course of her illness, she kept a journal. And we had conversations because she wanted to write a book to help other women get through what she was going through. And her journal also was very much about her fears, her hopes, some of her frustrations about me and how I was handling things. So it was very personal. You know, it had a part of it was... things where lists of things she needed to accept, lists of things she needed to let go. And, but then a part of it also were thoughts about maybe if she could turn this into a book. Now, it never reached that point. And a lot of it was very much for her. Most it was, you know, but I would say 18 months or so after she passed, at some point my computer broken down, and I was going, and I was using her computer while mine was getting fixed. And I finally had the courage, because I knew all the stuff that she had on her hard drive, but I finally had the courage to open it and read it. And I would say I was probably 50, 100 pages into the book, and I'm into the novel, and I'm mapping things out and trying to figure out how it's going to go. And when I start reading those, you know, those journal entries, well, there she is. And her voice is so strong and it's so clear. And it did knock me for a loop. It's so powerful. And especially when you, for example, read your wife some sentence that says, while she's in a hospital and going through very serious treatment of Charles is often miserable, I am not. You know, in talking about how she keeps her mindset and her attitude. And, you know, and it's the kind of thing that just makes you want to go in bed and curl up for hours. The truth is that that also made me aware, or that something in me, it hit a switch, and I knew that there would be a point, that there could be a point in this book where it came from Alice's, directly her voice.
Mm-hmm.
The third part of the book would be her going through being hospitalized, going through this bone marrow transplant, being at a certain point in her marriage with Oliver, feeling a certain way about her being forcibly separated from her daughter and not knowing if she would see her again or how things would go. And that this would be, you know, the gamble of the book would be not telling the whole thing in her voice, but mm-hmm. making a reader wait to get to this.
Mm-hmm.
But that if at the point, at the most dramatic, as it enters the most dramatic third of the novel, if then we go right to her and get to hear this woman and get to really go through the experience with her with no separation, that it could really be beautiful. And I didn't. It's not word for word the journals. You know, I had to change a lot. There's a lot I couldn't use. There's a lot I had to change into Alice's voice. But there's things that are like, it's the foundation. You know, and it gave me a direction, and it gave me an understanding of what, much more of an understanding of how she was feeling while I was, let's say, sitting by the side of her bed, and she was quiet or thinking or crying. You know, those journals gave me more insight than our conversations or my experience could have, and so I thought it was a beautiful way to help keep her spirit in the world, and also to share that experience, and also to be with her, you know, and then also from the Department of Self-Interest, you know, that it could maybe make a beautiful book that could mean something to people.
Do you think you could have written the book without her journal, or do you think it would have been a different book?
It would have been a different book. If I didn't have that journal, I wouldn't have known. It would have had to be something else that would have triggered that idea of, oh, I could move this into that section. And the truth is that section is, the other parts of the book work very well. They do everything they have to do. The beginning is a landslide of emotion and of momentum, and then it complicates and the drama gets deep and interesting, but it's to all get to those 150 pages of the last third. And if I didn't have those, I would have had to organize things differently and think about them differently. And it would have been a different book. It would have been a very different book. Yes.
Do you think she would have had any objection to you using her journal in that way? Or for the inspiration?
You know what? It's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
I think that, one, she wanted to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
Two, and that's really important. That's a big thing. Two, my Diana was a lovely and kind person. She was also my first reader about everything. She's someone who we talked about my artistic life, about her artistic and professional life all the time. And I think she would have been up for it and thought, right, this is something you'd have to do. I think she would have seen how good it was. And three, I think that just as a person, I think that that she would have been like, you should use my journals. Mm-hmm. You darn well should. My voice should be out in the world. You should do it well. Do it right. If you're going to do it, do a good job at this. I deserve this. You know?
So was part of it sort of honoring that desire of hers to be a writer?
I think it helps. I think It absolutely plays in. I think there's a part of me that it certainly allows me to feel good about about the book and what I'm doing. I could understand if like we were divorced and I stole the book from her, from her papers, and it wasn't my property and wasn't my right, and someone saying, how could you do that? But we were a team. We were
a
great team, and we really were intertwined, and that doesn't mean that every day and on everything we saw eye to eye, but through her inductions, through her both bone marrow transplants that she went through, I slept every night with her in the hospital, in the cot next to her. I was there for everything. So it's not something that I have any second thoughts of, because I just know how close we were.
Yeah, yeah. Charles, we only have a couple minutes until our next break here, but were there any surprises in what she wrote? Anything that maybe, took your breath away a little bit or caught you by surprise?
The thing that is, like I said, the one line I mentioned that Charles is often miserable, I am not. When I read that, the recognition of how smart she was and of what was happening, and how miserable I was and how scared, and that was, I don't know if it was a surprise, but it was so powerful. I think it's a surprise just to read, to miss someone and then to see them, to see all their nuances and their humor and their light and their kindness and generosity in page after page. And that's something that I did really enjoy. I really enjoyed and cherished about being able to look through those pages and then to work with them.
Did it bring any regret to you?
Well, the big thing I regret is that she's not here to help raise our daughter.
Yeah.
If there's any regret, the littler things...
They pass.
Yeah, they really do. They really do. I mean, you always feel that you could... There's little thing, miscommunications or little tug of wars that you wish would have been different. But the larger truth of how much people, how much you cared for someone and how much they cared for you. And you just kind of want them around.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Or that's how I am. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, definitely deep, deep, heartfelt. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're having a really meaningful conversation.
You really are.
Yeah. You didn't know you were going to go this deep, huh?
You need the right person to go really deep with, but yes.
Charles Buck is the author of Alice and Oliver, really a book that we want to recommend to all of our listeners. We have a lot more to discuss with Charles. He's going to stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Azi, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Cancer, it's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you a breakaway from cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Insight Corporation, NovoCure, and Taiho Oncology. I'm Kim Tibaldo, and our guest today is author Charles Bock. Charles' first book, Beautiful Children, was a New York Times bestseller, a notable book of the year, and won the Sue Kaufman Prize for a best first novel from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His second book, Alice and Oliver, has just come out, and while it's a book of fiction, it is based on real-life experience. Charles' wife, Diana, was diagnosed with leukemia soon after giving birth to their daughter, Lily. Despite being treated with chemotherapy and two bone marrow transplants, Diana succumbed to cancer in 2011. I want our listeners, Charles, to just get a flavor for this book. So I would love to ask you to read a short excerpt from the book. Could you set the scene for our listeners and then take us there?
Absolutely. Alice has been home, or had induction. She's been home for a little bit. New tests are unclear about what's happening in her body, and it's about time, and it's close enough time to where to chemo, where the best thing they can do, because they don't know about these 5% of cells, is to just start a consolidation. And this is the night before she's going to go back into the hospital. They're packing everything up for her stay. And it's her and her husband, Oliver, on the couch while they're packing.
Okay.
And being bald is horrid enough, Alice said. And eyebrows don't matter so much. But I always had pretty eyelashes. Alice, just please look at me. Your mommy's going to be a tree, Alice told Doe. Or how about a smooth, bald butterfly with no eyebrows? After a few more moments, she gave in and turned toward her husband. His hand went to the underside of her chin. You still have your eyelashes, he began. They're thinner, she said. When I put on eyeshadow, I can tell. You are gorgeous beyond words. It's horrible to feel vain about these things, she said, but I can't help it. And I think that's the excerpt.
It's really beautiful and paints such a picture for us. Charles, I can't help but really kind of note the contrast between your first novel and your second novel, certainly.
Yeah, massive difference.
Massive difference. And really for our listeners, you know, your first first book about beautiful children, about prostitutes, pornographers, teen runaways.
Las Vegas.
In Las Vegas. Talk to us, you know, really as an author, as a writer, was the process of writing this, I imagine, was quite different than the previous novel. Can you compare, contrast for us your sort of experience as a writer in those two pieces?
Yeah, well, the first novel I wrote, I didn't know what I was doing, and it took me forever. It took me a really long time to write it, and I kept having to try and figure it out, and not just figure out how to write a book, but figure out what my story was, and it ends up moving between times, and it's kind of like lost in that there's levels and layers to it, and it's got 8-10 different main characters. It's just a big, wonderful, messy first novel where I'm just, you know, where I just went for everything. This book, and the truth is, Diane and I used to say, I just don't know what you're going to do next. I don't know how you could possibly follow that up. And we used to laugh about it. This book is just it's different. It's such a different idea behind it. In this book, I really wanted to focus on these two people, on the idea of love, and even when it's challenged and pushed, and on what we owe to one another and what we owe to ourselves, the experience of her cancer and of a bone marrow transplant, I felt, and of the day-to-day ordeal of going through these different challenges and these different questions and financial pressures and insurance pressures and doctor nurse bureaucracy relationships and what it does to these people, what it does to everyone. I felt like they had a natural story to them. They gave it a natural immediate timeline and arc, and that I could hone in on and work with in a way where I didn't have to flail around so much. This book was emotionally, I knew the emotional heart of the book was going to be intense, and that it would be a book with a lot of heavy, heavy stuff going on. And so it didn't need to be too flashy. It didn't need to go crazy, because it was just going to be a deep experience. And I think that allowed me to be focused in a way that when I was writing the other book, any good idea I had, I would be like, oh, well, maybe I could try this. And who knows where that could lead. That could lead down a dark alley to nothing, or it could lead to something great. But this gave me a much different experience. And then I could also felt like I could use time and humor as places to give a reader some breath. Places to laugh, places to catch their breath and recompose themselves. But it was all, I always felt like I had, that this is a great, that this is the story, the life and death stuff, and makes great possible art. And I wanted to really honor that and to try and capture that on the page.
So Charles, you were quoted as saying that writing the truth often requires invention and imagination in order to make, you know, real, quote unquote, real details seem real.
Right.
I needed to make stuff up.
A little bit. Yeah.
So what truth or truths did you want to write? I mean, talk to me about, give me some framework for that quote, because I think it's really interesting.
I think there's an emotional that for me, for this book, there were some things that a little bit of distance, a little bit of changing things, a little bit of messing with what happened allowed me to get to the emotional heart of what was happening. Diana underwent a pair of bone marrow transplants. The second one was experimental after the cancer returned. If I would have tried to put in the novel both of them, I think it would have just been really even harder because you get through it once, you think everything's okay, and then to do it again, it was physically exhausting in a way in real life that you have no choice but to go through. But a reader does have a choice, and that choice is to say, I've had enough, goodbye. So,
yeah.
In this case, if I could consolidate them, and if I could take the emotional intensity from each event, and certain moments that I knew that happened in the second one, and certain things that happened in the first, and maybe you combine them into one afternoon or into a stretch of things that happen in a cause and effect manner, then it's a lot more focused, and there's a way of dealing with it. I think in every scene there were things where maybe I had observed something and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting, and then something where I thought, oh, well, here's a joke I knew or a story I knew or someone I knew, and maybe they said something that for some reason sounds interesting, and maybe I could put it in and work with it. So that it's kind of a collage and a bit of a magic trick. I needed to be able to put it in 1993. I needed to have Alice be a little bit in the fashion world, which is a world that I knew nothing about, but I could do research and I could add some Holly-go-lightly type stuff to her personality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I needed some of that so that I wasn't stuck in what had happened that I would never be able to get out of bed and would just be sad all the time.
So just, I have a quick minute until our next break, Charles.
I'm sorry.
It's a great conversation, but I just want to ask in that vein. So did it ever cross your mind to write a biography or an autobiography, or did you need that distance? Do you need that gap, that distance of the fiction to really be able to charge on with this project?
I needed it. I needed it. I had any thoughts that I would have had about it. I always felt that fiction was the way for me. And maybe, you know, I mean, there's like the beautiful, gorgeous memoir from the departed man, When Breath Becomes Air. And mm-hmm. he needed to write what was happening to him while he was ill.
Mm-hmm.
I needed some of the veils and some of the tricks and some of the things of fiction mm-hmm. to be able to get at the real truth of what we had went through.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that means that, you know, I'm not a number one memoir bestseller, but I'm very proud of and love my book a lot. And and that's what I needed to be able to write it.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're having a really amazing and in-depth conversation with Arthur Charles Bach. His new book is Alice and Oliver, and it's a must read. And I know that our listeners would have a tremendous amount of appreciation for this amazing work. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm your host, Kim Thibodeau. We've got more to discuss with Charles. Please don't go away. We will be right back.
Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Magnolia Meals at Home, a new pilot program that aims to help patients by providing nourishing meals to households affected by breast cancer so loved ones can spend more quality time together. This program is currently available in and around two pilot cities, Andover, Massachusetts, and Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. Participants will receive one delivery of meals every month for up to 6 months when enrolled in the program. Each delivery includes up to 7 meals designed to help meet the nutritional needs of people living with breast cancer and 10 meals for family members. This novel program is brought to you by the AZI Women's Oncology Program, Magnolia. Cancer Care, the Cancer Support Community, and Meals on Wheels Association of America. To find out if you or loved ones are eligible, visit online at www.magnoliameals.com. Or call 617-733-5848. People living with breast cancer often find it difficult to ask for help, and many of the people in their lives want to help but don't know how. During National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Cancer Support Community is proud to support Meal Train, sponsored by Magnolia, which utilizes MealTrain.com, a free shared online calendar to streamline the process of giving and receiving meals for families coping with breast cancer. Help us reach our goal of 1,000 new breast cancer-specific meal trains this October. To learn more, visit MealTrain.com/MMT and enter the code MAGNOLIAB. Or visit us at cancersupportcommunity.org.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355. Or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope. You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Bristol Myers Squibb, Celgene Corporation, EMD Serono, and Takeda Oncology. I'm Kim Tibaldo. Our guest today is Charles Bach, and he's telling us about his new book, Alice and Oliver, which, as I said, I really do think is a must read for our listeners. Charles, your wife Diana was diagnosed, you received what you describe as an outpouring of support that changed your understanding of people. Talk to me about that.
Well, I'll tell you, Diana was diagnosed when our infant daughter was 6 months old. Mm. We had, my sister was in New York, but I really didn't have like family around. Writer friends, my friends, but also my wife's friends, They became our family. And people volunteered through the, we set up a Helping Hands website of people to help with food, to bring food, because as you know, cancer patient, and especially someone who's neutropenic or someone who's had a bone marrow transplant or has any, you know, when you have issues with those white blood cell counts, there's foods you can have, foods you can't have, places you can go, things you can't go, and it's high maintenance.
Yep.
Also having a six-month-old daughter who's been being forcibly removed from breastfeeding, high maintenance, just huge. And I'm a writer. She's a grad student. We didn't have any money. We don't, you know, like we don't have it. We don't have the resources available to pay off the problem. But people signed up and people came by with food and people took care of Lily when I was exhausted or when Diana was exhausted. They just sat with her. And years of this. She was ill for 2.5 years. There were 6 month stretches of remission after transplants, but as you know, those stretches are not healthy stretches. Those stretches are stretches of recovery and of immobility and of weakness.
Yes.
People were, I'm people rose to the occasion, and people shared, and people were great in a way that I could only stand back and say to myself, well, this is what the goodness of our race. This is the goodness of the human race right here. This is the reason where if you were going to say, what do we have or what is there worth saving about if aliens were going to come down and say, why shouldn't we wipe humanity off the face of the earth? You would point to people acting this way and say, this is why. And that, you know, I tried to put that in the novel. I tried to show how friends and people rose and how much it affected. And this isn't everyone. There were relatives, honestly, who couldn't, you know, where it's too sad or it's too hard and they have to step back. And, but mostly people stepped up, and it's just something that, I'll always be grateful for, and I'll always be aware of in trying to give back, because I never saw anything. I never was part of anything like that before.
It really does create some balance in the universe, doesn't it? When you're going through this
something, yeah,
horrible situation, and then you see that human kindness and the power and the strength of that. It kind of helps to at least to put things a little bit back on kilter in a difficult time. And we certainly witness it every day at the cancer support community.
Absolutely.
Charles, we're getting to the end of our show here, but would you tell us a little bit about Lily and tell us how she's doing and what she's up to these days? And do you ever imagine sharing Diana's journal with her?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. Lily is 7 and a half. I have all Diana's journals. I have her papers. Her mother has in Memphis just everything. I mean, I have in our apartment, we have everything. And, even in Diana's note about what she wanted, she wants Lily to have it. And Lily is an amazing reader. She's ready. She wants to read Alice and Oliver. I had to stop her, even at the book party when she saw the book. She opened it and she said, I tried to start reading it. It's a little more, it's for adults, but I want to read, you know? And I've told her that when she's 16, you know, to have at it. She's a beautiful, very smart little girl. She's very, she's growing up with a lot on her shoulders. She doesn't remember her mother. Children don't, you know, there's Freud has a term where he talks about that kids, once you turn three, children start to forget anything that happened to them before they're three. Or maybe when it's seven. I think maybe at seven, they forget anything that happened to them before they're three. And Diana passed away 3 days before her third birthday. So she really, you know, she has the pictures on the computer. She has the few videos we took. She has all the stories, but she doesn't know her mom. And just the other day, she said, "It's, you know, I want her to come back." I mean, she's still very. She's a little girl who doesn't get her mother.
Yeah.
I'm lucky in that I met someone and we're creating a family, and she's accepted Lily and takes her on as her daughter. And so I think we have a chance at a happy growing family. But I also know that, you know, for quite a long, that this is something that the child has to live with. And when she gets sad, even last night, I said, well, you get to be sad. It's not fair. And it's not right. And you have every right to feel the way you do. I miss her too, and I want her back too. And we do get to feel this way, and you're right to feel this way. But this is also, you know, that's not all we get to feel. We also love each other, and we still have to put our toys away. It's not an excuse to not live and then not try and do the right things. So we're plugging along.
That's great. We're just about at the end of our time here, Charles. I think I need another hour or more. So much more to talk about. We didn't even really get into the some of the issues in the marriage of Allison Oliver, which I know were quite really intense at times and rather personal. Just a lot that we didn't cover, but certainly a lot that we did cover about this amazing book and amazing story and your own story and really pouring yourself and Diana's story into this novel in so many important and significant ways and unsubtle. Subtle ways as well, which I think is really fascinating. So I want to thank you for coming onto the show today, for sharing a little bit about your own life story and your family, and as well as letting us sort of peek behind the curtain and see how this writing really happens and all of the influences that sort of channeled into this amazing piece of work. So it's just an honor for us to have you with us. I want to encourage our listeners to get a copy of your book. And I want to remind folks that we have many, many free services for people with cancer at the Cancer Support Community. So check us out at cancersupportcommunity.org, or you can give us a call at 888-793-9355. So thanks for joining today for Frankly Speaking About Cancer. And until next time, be well, do well, live well.
Thank you for joining us for Frankly Speaking About Cancer with your host, Kim Tibaldo. We're here for you every Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. In the meantime, stay connected online at cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.